Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy? I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the man who will follow him across the desert, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, we specifically agreed that you would be the man in black there, and you've made yourself into the gunslinger. That's not fair.
Sorry, much cooler role. Had to steal it from you at the last second. But yes, we are talking about The Gunslinger by Stephen King.
That's right. Now, this is the beginning of one of the all-time big fantasy series. It's like one of the big ones, capital T, capital B, along with The Wheel of Time, The Lord of the Rings. This is Stephen King's big, interconnected, Michael Moorcockian, connected universe-spanning epic.
Oh, it is, Geordie. There is so much to dig out of this one. And from what I'm going to, mask spoilers for ahead, call quite humble beginnings, this series goes large. And I am yet to read the whole series.
Yes, this is my first time reading The Gunslinger. It's my third ever Stephen King story after Misery and The Stand, which I read last year. Duncan, if I'm correct, you've only read one Stephen King story before this, right?
I've actually read two.
Oh, okay.
I've read The Shining and Through the Eyes of the Dragon.
Oh, right, yes. His other fantasy story. That's like his first standard fantasy book.
I think it's his first one. I very much thought it was sort of a standalone work. It's good. I enjoyed it.
Cool. Maybe it gets connected to In the Dark Tower.
Maybe. More on that later. But Geordie, who are we and what are we doing here?
Well, at Is This Just Fantasy, you and I, Duncan, every 2 weeks we get together, we rate, read, and review a fantasy novel.
That we do, Geordie. And Geordie, have you read anything else this week, though, besides the big book? Obviously, Gunslinger wasn't that long.
No.
I thought it would be thicker, given Stephen King's reputation. So, any other spare time? Any other else you read and give a little quick review to?
Did I read anything else? No, I didn't. We actually had to delay this episode for about a week because I was on holiday and I wasn't able to record. But I still didn't read anything else except for this one. Even though this is a really short book, like a quarter of the length of Dune, it took me about a week longer to read it. I wasn't doing a lot of other reading in the meantime. But I do have some other things I'd like to chat about because I had an interesting, fantastical experience, which is that the other day I went up to London and I saw Spirited Away. Not the film, although...
Oh, you lucky man!
I love the film. The theatrical version of it, like on stage at the London Coliseum with all these beautiful, massive puppets.
I'm so jealous of you. I have seen that. Clearly the algorithm knows I would want to go and see it. YouTube just shows me nothing but it. I haven't managed to get tickets. How was it?
It was great. I've seen both the theatrical versions of Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro. They're both incredible. I hope for nothing else but more and more theatrical versions of Ghibli movies. It was phenomenal. It was extremely faithful to the movie. Almost astoundingly so in many places. Even doing like visual gags that do not work on stage but worked in film, like when she like stumbles down the stairs. I was like, well, you don't do that. That didn't work. Like, she can't. Anyway, but no, it was an incredible experience. It was beautiful. It was well acted. The music was, oh my gosh. And it was all done by Japanese performers. You know, My Neighbor Totoro was done in English, but this was in Japanese. They had, the London Coliseum is used to show opera a lot of the time. I've actually only been there before to see The Rheingold, where they have subtitles. Even though that was in English, they still had subtitles. And I needed them, because it was opera. But the music was incredible, and way more on point and like literal to the plot of what's going on than I ever realized before. Beautiful stuff. Recommended to everyone. If you are living in the UK, there are tickets lasting until August, and you should absolutely snap it up. It's worth however much money they're asking for.
Such deep-seated jealousy. I really hope I get the opportunity. I've heard so many good things. My younger sister went to see My Neighbor Totoro, and she said it was one of the most visually stunning things she's seen on stage.
It really is. The puppets are different in Spirited Away, not so much in terms of difference in terms of style, but they have very radical approaches to it. My Neighbor Totoro basically has very different variations on the character of Totoro. Like, how many monsters are there in Totoro? There's Totoro-san himself, there's like the little blue Totoro, and there's the tiny white Totoro, and then there's Cat Bus. So they need many different puppets to represent those four characters. But Spirited Away has dozens upon dozens of spirits and gods, and all of them are represented by puppets. Those three bouncing heads, that is one guy wearing a mask, stripped down to a red loincloth, with two extra heads on his hands, and he just goes along going, it's fantastic.
It does sound incredible, Geordie. I feel like anything else I have to bring to the table will really pale in comparison to that.
I should have gone second.
Should have gone second. Well, I just read some books and some comics, because you know.
What did you
that's
read?
That's what normal people do. I read Leonard Carpenter's Conan the Hero.
On brand.
Hey, Robert E. Howard Conan Fasché, which I've had on my shelf for a long time now. And I had a moment, I finished Gunslinger early. I thought I'd give it a go. And it's very enjoyable. For those who are interested, it will probably don't pay more than a tenner for it. Because dear God, there are some insane prices online. Mm. It's a fun read. It takes the character of Conan. It puts him in this... He's a mercenary in a sort of Vietnam-style war setting.
I see.
So it's like he's in the sort of thick jungle. It sort of talks about the ideas of the fact that, you know, he's there with a very imperialistic military doing their standard war tactics and the playoff between what the local war tactics are. And it's got this whole kind of Vietnam dressing to it. It was a fine... And I mean, you know, fine, read. The other things I picked up this week, though, Geordie, it was May.
Ah, yes, May. Of course it was.
There was the always May the 4th Star Wars sales, and I picked up quite a few comics. Honestly, the current canon comics, they have got bloated, but I recently picked up Hidden Empire, which is the end of this trilogy of comics that's been set between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And it follows the character of Kurara, how you pronounce her name, from the Solo movie.
Oh, right, okay. Daenerys Targaryen.
Exactly. Yeah. And it follows her having this sort of small-scale rebellion, gathering up members of the criminal underworld to fight against the Empire, and brings in elements from the sequel trilogy, like the Knights of Ren, into what I thought was a decent plot. It was fun, goofy Star Wars, playing with lore elements and putting them in sort of the, you know, they were in the original trilogy, just behind the scenes kind of angle.
I see. So, are any of the new comics about, like, the modern age of Star Wars, or are they all set in the Imperial Rebellion period? I mean, I know you told me that all the books are now set in the ancient past, but... What about the comic books?
No, so the main comic book series, if you went out today and bought Star Wars issue, I don't know, 48, it will be set in the Imperial Rebellion era. They have had series that ran in the sequel era, like their Poe Dameron comic, and they've had some one-shots, some tie-ins directly to the movies. But to be honest, other than the Poe Dameron comic, which finished its run shortly after The Last Jedi came out, they've not touched that era. There was one comic called The Rise of Kylo Ren, which deals with Ben's sort of immediate fall to the dark side. But other than that, there is nothing. It's actually quite disappointing. One of my bugbears is the fact that when you go back to, like, when the prequels were coming out, if you went out and brought a comic book just titled Star Wars, it would be the prequels. It would be taking Jedi from that council scene in Episode 1 and putting them on their own little adventures around the galaxy.
Yeah, what's Yaddle up and when to? Just... Come on.
Mate, there's so much deep Yaddle lore, I think. I don't even know how Yaddle dies in the original Legends canon. I know she was stuck in a hole for ages.
That's all the only thing I know about Yaddle as well. She's the voice from the hole.
But yeah, so that's kind of where it's at. It's okay. It's definitely getting to the point that I'm feeling with the Star Wars comics, particularly the modern canon, where I'm not as thrilled by the books that are coming out. The High Republic is just not gripping me. It's too much, I don't know, low-level threat. And it's weird, because you're like, is this something that all prequels suffer from? You know where it's going. But, I don't know, there's just something about the villains in it. It's just not quite drawing me in. And the comics, like I just said, like, they've got some fun elements of what's behind the curtain. But the thing is, for me, who's read a lot of Star Wars, this is like the fourth time I've seen a canon take on what Luke and Leia and Lando were getting up to during the original trilogy. Like, it just feels very done. Oh well.
Oh,
it's hard life being a Star Wars fan.
I bet it is, Duncan. I bet it is. I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know. So, Gunslinger. Gunslinger. Duncan, you said this book was a bit of a letdown for you, didn't you?
I did. So, early in the week, me and Geordie sent a few messages back and forth. How are you finding it? What do you think? And I messaged Geordie, and this, to me, sums up my feelings on Gunslinger, like, the best. I said to Geordie, I was hoping for a bit more. One message. And then I instantly went, no, follow that message up. Geordie, I was expecting a bit more. From Stephen King, from the shadow that the Dark Tower has cast over the fantasy genre, I was so hyped. And that is a bit on me. And also, I need to make it so clear. You know, I'm trying to review the Gunslinger today. That's the book I read.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure the series gets bigger and expands and lives up to its reputation. But just reading this first book, I'm like, really? This is going somewhere? If this was the only book, Geordie, I don't think, and like, people, obviously the rest of the series didn't exist, I wouldn't be sitting here going, oh, I can't wait for the sequel.
No.
I probably wouldn't even be sitting here thinking, I'm going to read that when it comes out.
No, absolutely not.
I'd be like, I'm going to read one of Stephen King's other horrors.
It's really bizarre that this book is all about setup, but it does such a bad job of setting up any kind of excitement, because all it's really setting up is the explanation for what the Dark Tower is, which you have to wait until the last couple of chapters for. And you're not... So, it's hard to talk about this because, essentially, this book is a mystery. The whole point of this book is... The reason why it's fantastical is that so much of it is just not explained to you. You have to really be patient to wait for stuff to make some sense. You know, this guy is a gunslinger. But he's not a cowboy, he's a wanderer who has guns, and he lives in a world where other people don't really know what guns are. Well, that's interesting. He's from Gilead, he's from a place called Gilead, but it's not like biblical Gilead. I'm pretty sure it's just like a town in America, or I guess it is a city in America, that just so happens, like so many other American towns and cities, to be named after a town or city in the Holy Land. There's plenty of Jerusalems and Salems about in America as well. And they live in a slightly post-apocalyptic society, but that's not explained to you at first. At first, you think he's living in the Old West. And you have to slowly figure out that, no, they know about Hey Jude. That's odd.
Beatles song?
Yes.
My pop culture is not very high quality here. Probably more relevant at the time the novel was written.
Duncan, it's one of the most successful songs of all time. That's just on you, bro.
You're right, and it leaves this very lax kind of world building. It's like, it's always about hinting. This book hints and lays mysteries, and it does it continuously. And I'm sure this must be, you know, a factor in the later series' success, because obviously the payoff, maybe it's amazing. But this first book really only answers one question for you, and the rest is all left hanging.
Yeah, you still... So the first thing, and the most iconic thing about this book, is the opening line. Duncan, would you like to read it for us?
The man in black fled across the desert, and the gunslinger followed.
So right from the start, killer opening line. You can go further, you can talk about the desert, but immediately, even though it's not framed as a question, there's no question mark, that is a question. Who is the man in black? Who is the gunslinger? Why is he chasing him? And almost all of that information has to be very, very slowly unpacked throughout the rest of the book. It takes ages to find out that a man in black is a sorcerer. You never learn his name. It takes a long time to learn Roland's name, the gunslinger. And even at the very, very end, it's not 100% clear why he's chasing him. We know he has some sort of vendetta, but when he does catch up to him, and he shoots him, and the bullets just don't work, well, he just seems to be able to hang out with him without any great amount of, you know, hatred in his eyes. He doesn't really start cursing or swearing at him. He's quite patiently hearing him out and letting him experience prophecies, because he's really more interested in the Dark Tower, because he has to search for the Dark Tower for some reason. Someone told him to, but we don't know who, and we don't know why.
It certainly made me want there to be sort of a... what's it? From Princess Bride, Indigo Montoya character. Like, I really wish, like, the gunslinger Roland could just have a moment where he goes, "You did this, and now I'm going to kill you." Like, could you please just tell me your motivation? You killed my father.
The thing is that, like, it's not that there's anything, strictly speaking, wrong with ending a book with mysteries unanswered. Like, you can absolutely do that, and great authors are going to. Like, we just a couple of weeks back praised Empire of the Vampire and Empire of the Damned for doing just that. We have these mysteries that we still haven't solved, but we're desperate to know the answers. Something about this book, it's not satisfying to just have these questions and be left in suspense.
And I think to kind of answer why, we just need to look at the rest of the book. So, Geordie, this book, I hope you took away the kind of same feeling. I really felt like I was reading two almost separate short stories. That if there was a divider down the middle of this book, like it was sold to me in two different volumes, I wouldn't feel that was any more amiss than sort of the...
I think I know exactly what you mean, because what I was thinking at a certain point was, this kind of reminds me of, like, The Witcher Season 1, because part of it is about this guy who rolls into a town, and he's dangerous, and he has to deal with magic, and he leaves ruin wherever he goes, and that kind of feels like a Witcher short story. Geralt shows up, people hate him, he causes trouble, he has to kill a bunch of innocent people, he leaves town. But then the second part is the classic Lone Wolf and Cub, or the Geralt and Ciri, or the Ciri, whatever, I don't know, I haven't actually read The Witcher, I've only seen a TV show and played like an hour of the video game. But yeah, it's the classic rugged man looks after kid. Empire to Vampire, that's it too.
The Last of Us, oh, this is a fun game.
It's a very common trope. Wolverine and that one kid from Logan. Your turn, Duncan.
The Mandalorian and Baby Grogu.
Very good, yes. The Walking Dead video game with Clementine.
Why am I pausing now? This is way too early. I know there are hundreds more. Berserk. Guts and Puck. That's not right.
No, that's not right. Guts and Casca I can almost accept, but she's not a kid. I think you lost, bud. Sorry. Lost.
This is so shameful. I'm gonna wake up in the middle of the night and just like hit my forehead and be like, oh god, there are so many. God of War! Sorry. Yes. We're talking about, so there's two kind of elements to this story, and they feel very separate. So I actually feel like we should maybe address them in those two separate chunks. Because I felt very different. I felt very different about the character. I felt very different about the event. Even the writing and the pacing struck me as so different between these two sections. Like, I kind of feel like I need to do a bit more of a deep dive. I don't like to over-research the writing of a book. I don't want it to, like, influence, you know, my experience actually reading it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's somewhere Stephen King was like, yeah, I originally wrote this short story and then I expanded on it.
I have a theory. I have a theory that I developed whilst reading this book. I'll ask you this one thing, Duncan, because you tend to know this. When was this book first published?
I'm going to say 1990. And if I'm wrong, it's 1991.
Okay, that's interesting. Let's look it up. 1982.
Oh, I'm so wrong.
Yeah, I was surprised when you said it was the 90s, because I was pretty sure it was the 80s. And, well, I was reading a Wikipedia article to find that out. The Gunslinger was first published in 1982 as a fix-up novel, joining five short stories that had previously been published in 1978 and 1981. You're quite right, Duncan. It is a collection of short stories.
That makes so much more sense. Oh my god. Okay, I think, Geordie, if I had known that going into this first novel, like with The Witcher, great example. For those that don't know, The Witcher, the first two volumes in The Witcher, The Last Witch and Sword of Destiny, are just compilations of short stories, and the first novel is actually the third novel in the series, Blood of Elves. If I'd known that going in, I think I would have been so much more open to The Gunslinger. They'd gone, this is the prelude, and then this is the first novel. make so much sense.
I'm not gonna lie, I don't think these would be good short stories to read on their own. Like, The Oracle in the Mountains, that's the bit where he climbs the mountain and that's it. Oh no, but the flashbacks take place in that part, don't they? So I guess that's why you would read that section. And The Slow Mutants, I guess that makes sense why The Slow Mutants are there, because you're like, oh, I need some excitement to happen in this part of the story, so I'm going to have him be attacked by these underground mutant characters. Damn, it took him 12 and a half years to finish the novel. That is, that's surprising.
When did the last book... Sorry, this is not how I like to approach this, but now I am just like, how did the whole series come together? What's the structure of this?
Yeah, I'm confused too.
So, the first story... Okay, so it's 19... Wikipedia's giving me 1982... Then we have 5 years, 87, and then we get then we get 4 years, 91, then 6 years, then the next year, that must have been a short story, then we literally wait 5 years again to 2003, and then basically the whole series
gets... Are you looking at the Dark Tower or the Gunslinger?
The Dark Tower.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Gunslinger page.
On to our new segment called Reading Wikipedia.
Yeah, this is where we get our James Summerton inspiration.
Okay, so the Gunslinger was 78, The Way Station, 80, Slow Mutants. No, I don't think this is a bad breakdown. The Gunslinger is literally that opening section, just like the... It's just a mystery. And I think The Way Station gives you a fair bit of action. The Oracle in the Mountain, you introduce us to...
No, you're thinking of something else. The Gunslinger is the whole opening section where he goes to the town, he meets the bartender, he's pursuing a man in black, and he shoots everyone in town. That's the Gunslinger. The Way Station is when he meets the kid.
Oh god, so the Gunslinger is like nearly a third of the book, like the length of the other five stories.
Yeah, I reckon that's true. I
don't know why I'm confused at this. The book is literally set up into parts. I just thought they were parts. I also like the fact another...
Like, they're called chapters!
Do you know what? If it had like a summary at the front, like most of my short stories collections, because we've read short stories collections... Geordie, like, yeah, go back and listen to The Weird of the White Wolf. Like,
exactly. The Dark Tower is his version of, like, the Elric verse, where he has connects up all his different stories. Why can't it be chopped up into, this is deliberately telling you, this is the story of the Gunslinger. This is the story of the Way Station. I listened to this on Audible. I do not recommend that in the slightest. It is a really bad adaptation to Audible, because... You know how I just said all these different parts are called chapters? Well, Audible took that really literally, and each chapter, which is about an hour long each, doesn't get sub-chapter headings. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 chapters of The Way Station, which do exist within that story, you can't jump between them. You just have to listen to the whole thing through, and if you lose your place, tough luck.
Okay, so let's go back then to The Gunslinger. Because I think this first story, we can actually bring up some parts in the writing, in the characterization. And it's a bit of a shame you haven't read The Witcher, because that actually, I think, draws a great first comparison. The first Witcher story is simply titled The Witcher and introduces us to Geralt on a mission. He's shown up at a place. Let's go. So, The Gunslinger. He rocks up in what looks to us like a western town. You know, he wanders in off the beaten track and walks on down to the saloon. Oh, and the locals aren't very friendly.
Exactly. It's classic Western stuff. He really puts that inspiration on his sleeve. And it's great for a sort of pulpy style story. If you want to combine horror with the Western, I think that's a really apt decision. And I think definitely The Gunslinger... that first chapter, that first part of his story, it's definitely the best part of the book.
I'd agree. I think it clearly, because it knows what it's focusing on. It's focusing on Roland and his immediate mission. It's not getting too lost in trying to throw up these sort of, it's not laying too many breadcrumbs. I felt like later on, it's like Stephen King's taking a handful of breadcrumbs and just scattering them to the wind. Whereas this is like, okay, he's chasing the man in black and he's just telling us, we know he's hunting them across the desert, and the setup to this story is Roland the Gunslinger is going to tell us what happened when he rode through the last town. And what happens, Geordie? I mean, occults?
Evil magic numbers?
There are bits in this, and I think, I don't know if this is true of a lot of Stephen King work, where it can, at one point, he walks a very delicate line, I feel, between a concept being cool and a concept being silly.
Yes, he will walk that line with great confidence.
Let's talk about this then, the gunslinger. There's a mystery here when he's in town. You know something's not right. We know that there's this new sort of preacher in town. It's got some creepy vibes. And we know that there's this young man in town we get introduced very early on who's been touched by the man in black. The man in black's done some sort of necromancy. And everyone's very scared. And no one's quite sure what's going on. I liked this as a mystery. Because I don't know who the man in black is. I still really don't. And I'm like, okay. So we know he's a wrong end. He's causing strife. And it's almost like he's causing strife in his wake. And the gunslinger is going to try and fix it as he goes along. I think that's a really nice setup. I like the fact that
it's
Roland...
very much... You get the sense that he's very much like the... Well, he's very similar to, say, Guts, for example. I wouldn't be surprised if there is some inspiration to the character of Guts from the gunslinger. They weren't created that many years apart.
And I like the fact we have a really nice scene early on where Roland goes into the bar. He's up at the bar. He's ordering some food. I think there's a reference, I'm not quite sure, where he talks about wanting some bread and some salt. And the person's like, I'm not giving you that. I didn't know if this was meant to be if you give them bread and salt, you'll be safe under my roof. Or if it's meant to infer that salt's really expensive or valuable.
I don't remember that. I think both are plausible. I remember something about salt, and I think I took that second inspiration. I think that's what I took away from it, yeah.
But when he's at the bar...
I mean, I don't know where you get salt in the desert, right? Salt comes from salt mines in the sea.
You're right. Solid point. So I can kind of see that. It's setting up then that this is a hard done by part of town. And we get a nice bit, but he's at the bar, and people... Does he have a sense...
2 hamburgers, and they go, my God, we've never seen a man eat 2 hamburgers before.
An important point. This is Geordie popping in the future to say, I have no idea why I said hamburgers instead of hamburgers. I'm deeply ashamed. I said it twice as well. What the hell was going on?
I'm like, what, are you guys all scraping your living together to pay for one?
Maybe. I like how Roland is just walking around like a pocket full of gold. He's super rich. It's one of those things right from the start. It's that mystery who are you? Why do you have so much money? Why are you so itinerant? What? Why are you chasing this guy? Please explain. But he won't. And I think to begin with, that's really compelling. But you're right. There's a guy who's come through who's done some necromancy. And Roland's investigating it, and he basically sticks around in town just because he likes the bartender. But then he, investigates the local church, and she's preaching about hellfire, and she's described as being very attractive, but he's very sexually attracted to her anyway, even though she's a woman in a burlap sack. And then the entire town, per her orders, attacks Roland. And Roland kills literally everyone in town.
I mean, yes, that's what happens. There's a good scene early on where Roland kind of does some people are sneaking up behind him in the bar, and he kind of just puts his hand on his guns, I feel, and he's just like, don't try it.
Exactly, so we get classic cowboy stuff.
So we get kind of that, he's capable. And... when it comes to that final action scene, when it all kind of goes down, and this isn't massive spoilers, this is the first fifth of the book. What do you think of that action, Geordie? Because I was a little bit it's getting a bit messy for me. This isn't what I would describe as top tier action.
I found it pretty boring. I think it's really hard to write a John Wick novel,
What do you mean, this particular style of action?
There's a reason why gun-fu is relegated to the movies. I don't know if I've ever read, a really exciting gunfight in the same way I've read really exciting sword fights. Maybe that's just because I'm a fantasy guy, but even when I read sci-fi novels, I'm normally I care about the result of the gunfight, not the actual gunplay, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. The only example I can think of where I'm oh, that was a good gunfight, and even then there's a level of magic involved, was in Brandon Sanderson's Alloy of Law.
I knew you were going to say that.
Those gunfights are fun and they're intensive because they do a really nice job, which I often say, what really makes a fight fun is when you get to see what the character's thinking. You know, he's planning out his next move. I'll go there. Okay, I'll ping a bullet off there, or there's two guys coming round. I need to retreat for the moment. I'll dive over the bar. I just didn't feel like there was that kind of dynamic thought process going on in Roland. He just seemed to be, I'm going to shoot them, and I'm going to slug a few hits, and I'm going to keep shooting them. And I'm not sure when he reloads his guns.
Well, I'll tell you when he reloads his guns, because this is interesting. He says, basically, at some point he gets hit in the head, and he kind of gets, like, knocked out a little bit, but his hands keep fighting for him. Like, the idea, I think, is that he's so honed as a warrior and a fighter that, like, he doesn't even need to think. His hands will do it for him. And a phrase is used several times, which is his reloading trick. And this especially caught my attention because whilst I have never seen the Dark Tower movie starring Idris Elba, I have seen the scenes where he loads his guns. And when he loads his guns, it looks really cool. Have you seen this, Duncan?
I have not.
Okay, so just to begin with, actually, I'm going to say one thing first. First of all, I'm not a big gun guy at all. I don't really care for guns. I'm in favor of stuff like gun control. I live in Britain. I've fired a couple of guns in my life, and it's fun. I know why people enjoy doing it, but it's just not really my thing. But there is something really tactilely nice about the clicky-clackiness of guns. I appreciate why people like seeing things like bullets going into revolvers or speed loaders, because or seeing like 3D x-ray models of how guns fire, because it's nice to see how the different parts fit together, the same way people like to see how steam trains work. So when you take it up to 11, like in the Gunslinger movie, it looks really, really cool. To put it very bluntly, Duncan, this is how Idris Elba loads his guns in the movie. And first, and one more thing, Idris Elba looks really good at holding guns. He's just really good at pointing them. He looks good doing it. There's a reason why it works so well in The Suicide Squad, because that dude looks good holding guns. Anyway, a lot of people can't do that. Anyway, the way he loads the guns in the movie is he either loads it really fast with a speed loader, or he spins the barrel, he spins the chamber really fast, it's completely blurred, and he feeds the bullet in by just flicking his thumb, and he just like, flicks them out of his pouch, one by one into the chamber, and they perfectly go into place as it spins at ridiculous speeds.
Well, that sounds like something out of anime, but okay.
It is a bit, but it looks cool.
Fair enough, and I do like it.
Anyway, so I guess he's just doing that.
Yeah, well, at least you've got something to visualise, because he just says, if you just say to me his special trick, I'm like, what's that?
Yes, it's absurd.
I don't know. I barely know, I'm not going to lie, be on me, I don't really know how a revolver works. Is it a revolver he's firing?
Yeah, because of course, he's a cowboy. Well, he has 2 6-shooters.
Is that told to me? Okay, maybe that's... Not maybe that's more on me.
I don't think it's supposed to be told to you. I think the moment you're told gunslinger, you're supposed to think revolver.
Okay, fair dues. As I said, so
if nothing else, like, he fires 12 shots at a given time. We know that. So he's using a 6-shooter.
And he has 2. Got it.
And he has 2.
That's fine, but again, that's something where I feel like if you could expand on the description, you can write that in a thrilling way. Like, if he's going to do his special reloading trick, have it in a crucial moment. Have it where he's, like, someone's just lunging at him and he does his special trick, you know, where he flicks the barrel, chamber with his thumb, pings the bullet. I think a little bit more description to kind of give that kind of energy, which I personally felt was lacking.
Yeah. I agree. I don't think the actual gunplay was that interesting. And you're right. Saying his reloading trick, it means nothing. I had a visual reference because I've seen some clips on YouTube of Idris Elba doing it. But that is not fair. Like, I wouldn't have that in 1982.
So, that's that first bit in the opening story. The second bit in the opening story, and it is most egregious in the first story. There are elements of it later on. Mate, I was not enjoying any of the sexually charged interactions in this book. Was I meant to?
Yeah, very cringe.
Very
There's
cringe.
A bit where a girl, like, seductively pinches her nipple at Roland, and it is like, boy, what?
I'm like, Stephen, is this what you think is sexy, or is this what you think your readers think is sexy? Because
it's genuinely a little bit grotesque. It's so gratuitous. Like, even just the way in which it's written that this lady invites Roland into her bed, it's so unconvincing that these characters would ever be interested or care about each other. It feels like this is just the expected thing. Like, Stephen King says, well, I'm writing a fantasy story about this rugged, wandering hero, so he has to be a Conan type. He has to be bedding willing wenches.
Listen, mate, I mean this in the nicest way, but Roland, he's not as charming as Conan. And that is not a high bar to hit.
No, not at all. But he's not supposed to be either.
Yeah, I found this a little bit... gave me the ick, in better terms.
Yes.
And so...
good youthful term, Duncan. You're always being down with the kids.
When I first heard that, I was like, what do you mean? Articulate more. It sounds like I'm asking someone who's telling me they've got the ick for me. No, yeah, I heard someone use that. I was like, what do we mean? Everyone else in the room seems to know what they mean. So that was really kind of uncomfortable. And that just kind of led into the rest of it, where I'm like, I'm not enjoying the action as much. I am enjoying this mystery. But the actual moment to moment, I'm not... this isn't a rip-roaring ride, which I think the first story of The Gunslinger is meant to be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's supposed to be this pulpy Western story, you know? But there are no other people to have shootouts with. There are only civilians to gun down, and later mutants who never seem to actually pose a real threat. And at that point, to be honest, I was so fed up with the book that I really wasn't paying that much attention. I don't know why the kid fell to his death, and I didn't even bother to go back and read it again to find out why. He just fell off something.
Oh, Jordy, I love it. They just like jump. Yeah, just jump to the plot spoiler. Like, let's just go. Let's just get it done. I don't care.
So you said the book had two parts, even though we now know it has five. I agree, it has two parts. It has pre-boy and post-boy, just like the God of War series.
You're right, it does. And I will be honest
with you. That's another Blow Wolf and Cub!
I said that earlier! Right.
Oh, you did? Oh, my bad.
So, you're right, and it does have a post-boy. Now, I'm going to say, it gets better. I enjoyed, once we get this Wolf and Cub story going, I believe the kid's name's Jake.
Yes.
Much more enjoyable. Roland actually has, like, a human character to interact with. Ali, the woman he meets in the first story, doesn't count. She's not given a character. It's nice to have someone who is a bit more relatable so that we can see Roland through slightly different eyes.
Kinda, yeah. I see what you're saying, and it gives Roland a chance to do weird and interesting stuff. The fact that Roland could do hypnosis using his bullets was so out of nowhere and so weird, but I really liked it.
I do too. I thought, yeah, this is... because we need to be reminded that this is a fantasy setting.
Yep.
There's a thorn in the first pitch section. Did I mention that? Is there like a thorn?
When you say a fawn, you mean like a satyr?
Yes, a satyr.
Is there... where?
This is where everyone discovers that Duncan was reading at 2 in the morning.
This is where everyone discovers that Duncan was maybe the only one who read this book. I might be having an Empire of the Damned moment here, because I might not know how this book ends. Where was the goat man, Duncan? Are you talking about when he had, like, a vision on the mountainside?
I'll be brutally honest. I might have gone mad. I've just googled what happened to the fawn in Gunslinger. And apparently people have searched for it, though. But it's not referencing... No. Okay, I was mad. Forget everything I just said, Geordie.
No. Why did you think there was a fawn?
I thought the bloke, he must have just had like...
what bloke?
Woolly trousers on. I thought they were telling me he was a fawn. The guy in... In the man in black of the first section, there's a bloke. No.
Oh my god. Are you talking about the guy who's wearing like buckskin trousers?
Yeah.
Duncan, buckskin trousers is just a type of trouser. It means you're wearing trousers made of deer hide.
Yeah, I may have made an oopsie in the early hours.
I think, Duncan, maybe you just haven't seen a lot of westerns. Is that right?
I have watched one, maybe.
Back to the Future 3?
Yes. How did you know?
Okay, there we go. Okay, so anyway, there are no goat men in the story. There is a guy who wears trousers.
And there is a man who hypnotizes people with bullets. And I liked on the soft magic here, there's another bit of magic in this opening section where he uses a jawbone as sort of like a talisman to like ward off mental illness.
Yeah, that was super interesting.
Cool concept. Not really going too deep. Not like the lore. Not like this is a spell cast by the sorcerers of Exelon. It's like, it's just sort of this more, almost like spiritual nature. Like, this is sort of like the natural magic of the earth. I'm not going to explain it to you.
Absolutely.
It works.
Yeah, he just knows it's magic, and he just somehow knows that it will protect him. And later, when he encounters the man in black, he reaches for it and discovers that he's lost it. And you're right, that just one thing is so effective. And that's a great example of, like, a mystery which doesn't need to be solved. It doesn't need to be explained. It just stands by itself, and you say, yep, that works for me. I'll tell you something else in the story that I really like. And that is just that one part of the second chapter, the way station, where it's just Jake living a normal life, and Stephen King describes to us, like, the small mundanities of Jake's life. It reminded me so much of all these little short stories of just regular people in the stand, and how good he is at making their lives seem interesting, or mundanely sad, or just a tiny bit tragic. He's really good at writing those sorts of scenes.
So just to be clear, the character of Jacob, this small child we meet in the second section of this story, and it's made very clear that he came from a, by all accounts, our world, New York. And on one tragic day, he has an interaction with the man in black, and he falls into the road and is run over by a car. In what I will have to say was slightly too graphic for my liking, but
way too graphic. It's the sort of thing where sometimes Stephen King, he did this in The Stand, where sometimes what he uses for horror is just gore. And I've never found gore to actually be scary. It's just either gross or cool. And this was just gross. Like, people get hit by cars and they don't burst.
So what happens in this description? It's not just like, you could do this scene and functioning to the reader, you know, all Jake needs to know is that he's falling. He hears the screech of a car tire and then blackness. But no, he sees his middle get squished. He knows blood shoots up out of his mouth. It is gross, and I did not like it. I don't know what to do, because on the one hand, like you said, Stephen King, he does this. And maybe there's like a horror reader who's like, that's my man. This is what I'm here for. But for me, it was out of place for this point in the story. Particularly, I'm not going to lie, considering that we had an action scene in the first section, the gunslinger, and that wasn't overly gory. People got shot and people just went down. It wasn't like bullets took off bits of their skulls and carried their eyeball out the rear in some sort of like berserk style artistry of just mantling people.
Yeah, I see your point. I see your point, Duncan. And I think the reason for that is that you're supposed to see the gunfight and the gunslinging as more tragic than exciting or scary. It's supposed to be like, oh man, he doesn't want to have to kill these people, but he has no choice. And that's how evil the man in black is for making him do this. Whereas Jake's death is supposed to be scary. And that sort of gory death can be really scary, because that's a lot of the fear and horror in Misery. That's about disempowerment and about like a man slowly being broken by an evil woman. There's a scene in that where a man is murdered with a lawnmower, and it's really scary.
I genuinely don't want to know anymore. Maybe I'm not for horror. I know.
You picked this book, Duncan.
I know I did. I'm fantasy. Yeah, and so again, that again, a taste thing maybe. Not for me. But you're right, I enjoy the mundanity. I enjoy the fact that we're bringing in this character. The idea, having a multiverse and having a character from our world, a fish out of water, that's kind of cool. Now, what you more traditionally expect...
Yep. And I know what you're going to say
here. Not critique, but just something I would often see, is that when you have a character who comes from one world into the fantastical world, that's the opportunity for your big buddy bear Roland type to then start explaining crap to the young child.
Yeah.
And I thought, ah, well done, Stephen. I see you. This is that, and that's going to tell me what's going on.
And instead, it's, doesn't happen. It's the opposite. Not only does Roland not explain anything to this kid... And in fact, it's explained away that a kid is super observant, so that Roland doesn't have to explain these things, and he just goes along with everything Roland says. It's even the other way around. This kid, who, by the way, like, has amnesia, when he wakes up in Roland's world, he doesn't remember much about his own world except for details. Like, for example, he knows he comes from a big city full of skyscrapers. He knows that it has a Statue of Liberty, but he doesn't know who his parents are. He doesn't know what his dad does for a living, but he knows he has a job. He can, like, recognize a subway station, but he can't describe what it is. So he has this hazy memory of his world. And most of the time, the elements of Roland's world which match ours, it's the kid's job to identify what they are, like identify a subway station.
And it brings up even more questions, and this is something that, you know, I'm very interested in. Roland's world. Because we get some flashbacks to early on in Roland's life. Geordie, this might have been my favourite bit of the novel.
Yeah, I agree. I like this bit a lot. I don't think it's as good as the better parts of The Gunslinger, because I don't think it's as cohesive. But yeah, I enjoyed this section as well.
So we get, I think, two or three times in this book, sort of extended flashbacks to early on in Roland's childhood, before he becomes the gunslinger, where, from what I can gather, he appears to be living in a, I don't want to say medieval society.
A somewhat feudalistic society.
I don't know. For no reason, I picture this as being like somewhat Georgian, but that's just out of thin air.
Yeah, that is out of thin air, because what you should take away from it is that it is a, I guess, a post-apocalyptic society. Like, maybe something you'd kind of see in, like, Fallout or something. I mean, more post-apocalypse than that, but the point is that at some point in the past, Roland's world was like ours, it was sophisticated, and then things fell apart. So guns are like an ancestral heirloom that gets handed down. That one detail is kind of fantastic. Like, the way in which that is conveyed to us, it's never explicitly stated, but you're given enough information and those objects are held in enough reverence for the guns of your father and how heavy they are and how well cared for they are. That conveys everything. But there's still these, like, stock fantasy experiences, like the harsh mentor, ritualistic combat, oaths, like, remember the face of your father, things like that. It creates and mingles this sense of slightly lost modernism with fantasy elements, with a sense of antiquity, and it blends the two. They know Mother May I, they sing Hey Jude.
And more references that probably went over my head. I really do like this aesthetic, actually, and I did like it. Maybe I didn't pick up on it as much in these scenes.
Duncan, obviously, can I just interrupt to say, Hey Jude is the Beatles song that goes, na na na, na 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 na, na 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 na, Hey Jude.
I'll listen to it later, mate.
All right, it's good.
I've lost track now. It's your beautiful singing. I really like that. That element, and to be honest, there's another book series where, well, two other book series. I know Mark Lawrence often uses this aesthetic, well, in his, both his Prince of Thorns universe, his Broken Empire, and in Red Sister, similar ideas, and I do like it. I think maybe in just this first book, I didn't see enough of it, particularly in those flashbacks. It's like, are we living in, like, the actual ruins, or is it just the guns? Is it our world? How close to our world?
That's a great
question.
How
long ago?
you want to know these things. And the real question is, how the fuck old is Roland?
I mean, that's a very good question.
Because, for one thing, when I begin this story, at a certain point I ask myself, is this the guy, like, literally Roland? Like, is he Roland?
Well, there's a bit in the first story of this, called In the Gunslinger. I say a bit, I might be misremembering, like, the damn fawn from earlier. But there's a bit in the first story where, when we first get his name, it's not... We don't get him, he doesn't tell someone his name. He says, as he left, Ali, like, calls him Roland, because that's the name I gave her.
Yeah.
But then for the rest of the stories, he's just Roland, and we flash back to Roland. But I couldn't get that first bit out of my head. Like, you might not be. You might be presuming Roland's life.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I can't explicitly remember characters calling him Roland in the past. But I feel like they must have. Like, do they just call him Boy?
They call him Boy, I think, an awful lot. Even his mother, does she call him Roland in her short scenes?
I can't remember. And I can't scrub through because I got the audiobook. So I'm afraid that's up to you, Duncan. If you want to try and look through it quietly, I'll mention this. So I said he's the Roland. Duncan, how familiar are you with the Knights of Charlemagne?
Were those the guys that kind of... I'm not going to know. Didn't the idea of like a paragon...
A paladin.
Or a paladin, sorry. Paladins exactly, come out yes. from them. Wasn't that one there kind of...
So, origin? There are two very important stories which connect to the Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, who is a real historical figure, not just a mythological one. Sometimes he's referred to as the King Arthur of France, but that's not really true because King Arthur is made up and Charlemagne actually existed. But essentially he's this very important European figure because he defended Western Europe from Basque invasions. And that has a humongous role in shaping world politics for all time. Like, some people say he basically invented the idea of Europe itself. But he was so important that he and his knights were mythologized in The Matter of France and The Legend of Roland. And it mythologizes these military campaigns, and it turns the character of Roland into a superhero. He can punch down castle walls. He fights 1,000 Saracen warriors for like hours at a time, whilst refusing to blow his magic horn that will summon aid to his side.
Badass.
Very badass. Another fun connection to the world of science fiction and fantasy is that the story of Roland inspired the Halo franchise.
I mean, yeah, punching down walls and taking it on solo, that is a Spartan.
I'm afraid it actually goes a little bit deeper than that. And basically, so Cortana, right?
Yeah, that's your AI companion in Halo.
Exactly. Cortana gets her name from, depending on your pronunciation or your translation, either Cortana or Curtain, who is a sword that appears in the, what's his name? Something the Dane. Olog the Dane, maybe? Who's a side character in the stories of the Knights of Charlemagne. And all of these knights and kings have special named swords. So Charlemagne's sword is Joyous. That's like the French Excalibur. And Roland's is Durindana. And when the Dane, whatever his name is, is gifted the sword. By the way, by Morgan Le Fay from Arthurian legend, when she gives him the sword, written on the blade, potentially by the blade itself, written on it is, I am Cortana, from the same steel and temper as Joyous and Durindana, meaning that she was made in the same forge out of the same steel as these other legendary swords. It's possible, depending on how you read that, that that's Cortana herself communicating with her wielder, which makes her the first ever talking sword in all of fantasy.
Okay, we just did a deep dive there I was not prepared for, and my main point is the idea of a multiverse has so old. Just like, yeah, the Arthurian guys and the French guys.
Yeah, that's a big crossover right there. I mean, given how you do it, like, ancient Egypt and ancient Greece were doing crossovers all the time, but that's not what we're going to get into. But speaking of multiverses, Michael Moorcock, of course, you might be well familiar with the character of Roland from the Elric stories.
Yeah, the character of Roland, who appears, it's like the character of Elric in the final book. He goes through a portal and actually runs into Roland, who is a paladin, I presume you're Charlemagne's court at one point.
Well, at that point, he's a corpse, but yes, he was previously a knight.
But he's getting a special item, isn't he? It's like...
Do you remember what it is?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
It's the horn.
It's like the magic horn. The horn. Oh, my God. So this is the guy. So when you said he wouldn't call it the horn that would call people to aid, that's the horn that Elric uses in... Oh, my God, this is so good.
Exactly. And when it's magically calls people to his side, and what does Elric need it for? It's to call the Lords of Law to his side to aid in the law between law and chaos.
And Roland, in the Michael Moorcock Elric multiverse, is one of the Eternal Champions.
It's
made very explicit that he's part of this. God, listen to a Weird of the White Wolf episode. Moorcock wrote the idea of that all like the great heroes are just like reincarnations of the same Eternal Champion. And as this demonstrates.
And it's particularly relevant to Roland because magic sword, and specifically the first talking sword, potentially, and who is the second talking sword in all of fantasy but Stormbringer in that very story.
Well, Geordie, what you're doing right now is taking an awful lot of time to tell me about all these weird and wonderful stories that sound so much more exciting than the one we've just read.
Should we press on and wrap up? Well, not wrap up, but talk about the final parts of the story, because we really stayed focused on the gunslinger parts.
You're right. Let's get back into, because you know, this book just has something more to offer, and that is this wolf and cub elements. Now, we get some really nice scenes where Roland makes a fire, he looks after the boy, it's made very explicit that he like loves him and the boy trusts him. And these,
yeah, it's made very explicit because it's written as a sentence, because we cannot rely upon their conversation to communicate this to us.
No. And that is a little bit of a weak point here. I don't think they're given... I think just more scenes. Like, talking about, like, affection. Like, it's told where we get literally told where Roland, almost in a conversation, like a hypothetical conversation with the man in black, he's like, but I love the child. And it would be nice, like, well, he could just, you know, put his coat over him when he falls asleep for warmth or a little thing like that. Just to show a bit more human emotion.
Yeah, we talked about, like, 9 different equivalent characters. Are any of them weaker than the relationship between Jake and the man in black?
I mean, Jake and the man in black. What, in terms of,
yes,
what, for all the characters in this book?
Comparing them to Kratos and Atreus, compare them to...
No, you mean
Clementine.
Jake and the gunslinger. That's why you completely threw me.
What did I say?
The man in black.
Oh, sorry. To be honest, I did keep imagining Roland also wearing black.
I do too, to be fair. Except he has a cool cowboy hat.
Yeehaw.
Oh my God, no, this is the weakest connection. Completely. Like, particularly going back to Empire of the Damned. This makes Empire of the Damned look so much better. And I like that book, but this makes it look like a shining star in terms of the Lone Wolf and Cub story. I felt so much more for Gabriel and Dion in that story here. Dior. It's just like, they're not given enough time to actually connect. And also, they're not given enough time of genuine tenderness or even opening up. That almost a bit goes back to what I said about...
Nor is there conflict.
Oh, what? Moments where they're tested.
Exactly. Like, there's one moment where it's tested where the boy, Jake, intuits that the man in black is leading him to sacrifice, and he's like, I'm not going with you because you're going to sacrifice me. And then he's like, okay, well, I'll abandon you here to deal with the mutants. And then the boy, crying, rushes up and throws himself into Roland's arms, and Roland reflects again, but he loves the kid. and you're like, okay, well, that was not real drama. Like, that is not an actual human experience of the push and pull of wanting to be with someone or being afraid of them or finding some sort of resolution despite complicated feelings. That was just a scene that you thought would be exciting in a book, and it wasn't, because it didn't feel genuine.
And not that I want to, like, rewrite work for Stephen King, but just if we had a little bit more of a moment there where Roland could stop, he could look back, he could wrestle with his feelings, and, like, he could make an actual sign that he cares for the Jake. This is the biggest thing, that it tells us he loves Jake very much. And I says, like, oh yeah, we're told he loves Jake. This scene doesn't show it, and he knows he's leading him to sacrifice. And the thing is, so as you told us all earlier, Jake dies. Jake is hanging off a precipice. I think some dodgy railway tracks. He's hanging off into the dark, on the edge of a dark abyss. And Roland looks back, and he looks forward into the light. They're coming out of a tunnel, and he sees, ah, there is the man in black. And he has this moment where he knows. He just knows. Characters just know too much in this story. If he turns back to help Jake now, he'll never. The man in black will disappear. He won't wait like he actually ends up doing. And it's meant to be this moment of, like, drama. We're like, oh, God, Roland, what are you going to do? And I think you're meant, when he decides not to help Jake, to be this pang, like this, oh, no, your vengeance has driven you too far. I'm like, but I don't know what he's getting vengeance for. I don't know his motivation for the man in black. I don't know how passionately he feels. And I don't really know how passionately he feels for Jake. Clearly, not that much. So there are no stakes. Because there's no time.
It needed to be set up a lot more. Like, the moment, like the equivalent moment, even though it resolves completely oppositely, would be in Berserk, in the conviction arc, where Guts sees Griffith again for the first time, and he charges at him full of hate and rage, but he turns back because he remembers that Casca's there. Like, that is a hugely emotionally profound moment. And it could be equally emotionally profound if Guts was to rush upon Griffith and, in the sake of pursuing vengeance, lost Casca. Or hell, the Empire of the Damned, where Dior dies in that exact same thing, where he chooses hate and vengeance over love, and it's tragic. I felt a lot more in both of those instances than I did in this. I was really checked out.
There's sort of a couple of things here that I feel like this scene is missing to have the drama, and one of them is the fact that I don't enjoy watching Jake and Roland really hang out that much. It's not like, oh no, I've lost all those good scenes I was going to read if they'd stayed around.
Yeah.
And another element which those stories have, I feel to quite a good extent, is that a lot of the time we have like a broken character. You know, Guts, he's full of his hate and vengeance. Gabriel, he's lost his faith. And through their relationship, Mandalorian, you know, he's completely to the cult and the way. But through their relationship with the younger child, like, you know, they open up, they change. They have, like, character growth through their interactions. But Roland isn't growing when he interacts with Jake. There's no real sign that he's changing.
No, because he can't. Yeah, the point of it is not that he grows and changes and he steps away from the path of vengeance to do something else. It's not that he grows, it's that he fails to grow. And that means that this dynamic, which is so successful in many other instances, has already kind of shot itself in the foot.
But Jordy,
like, it's supposed to fail.
I feel like that's not even where I'm getting at, though. Because that could work. This failing to grow, failing to learn the lesson. The problem here is that it's a non-start. I don't know what he's meant to learn or meant to grow away from in his interaction with Jake. I'm not clear that him not pursuing the man in black isn't actually what I should be rooting for. Because I don't know. Maybe the man in black
is about to kill
all of humanity. So actually, I want to be rooting for, oh my God, Roland, no, you just got to keep going. I know it's painful, but please keep pursuing. I don't know the stakes.
That's right. That's a good point. The personal and broader stakes are not clear. We know the man in black is evil, but only because of, like, specific things he's done and the way in which he's sown chaos. We know the world would be better if he wasn't in it because he can destroy towns worth of people. I guess that's that.
Is that the man in black or Roland you're talking about?
Yes, well, there we go.
And I'm not going to lie, the real thing that kind of just got this scene for me is that we've established that Jake can die and just wake up and on for multiverses. So I am a bit like,
only cool. If the man in black does it. I'm sure he's gone. Maybe he's not. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Oh, I don't think I will be.
Well, I think I might. People have to talk about this book series for a reason. Listen, let's talk about the last book. This might be good. I definitely didn't give it the time of day. I read it. It's fine. It's basically a lecture, like a TED talk by the man in black to Roland.
Yes, and in many respects, I'm like, I'm about to learn the answers to a lot of these mysteries. And I learned a little bit. I learned that the man in black has been around for a long time. I learned that one of the characters in the flashbacks, he is the man in black. Okay. Yep. But I still didn't really learn what he was responsible for. And then I finally learned...
Yeah, like, they still don't even say what he did to his dad. Like, presumably he killed him, but I genuinely, I'm not sure if that's true.
But I didn't care about that. See, the bit that interests me is the title of this damn series. The Dark Tower is brought up.
I think that I have a lot more respect for Philip Pullman after reading that chapter.
Please go on.
I mean, just the idea of multiple worlds and the way in which they could all be connected and that atoms themselves could be like a whole other universe in of themselves was just explained so much more aptly and concisely and interestingly in His Dark Materials than it was in this. Because it's just a lecture. It's literally a massive, endless dialogue by the man in black explaining a whole bunch of, like, stuff which probably feels really interesting. And maybe it was back in the 80s where talking about quarks and tachyons was really interesting. And maybe the idea that the word tachyon is being used in a fantasy novel is kind of bold and great. But essentially, it just takes a really long time to explain this. Well, at this point, it feels like kind of a rote idea about there is a multiverse, and it all makes part of this great continuum. I guess the Dark Tower itself and the idea that all of the substance that these universes make up is the Dark Tower. But we are still left with these big important questions, because I don't actually care about what the Dark Tower is. What I want to know is, why does Roland care? Why is this so important? Because this whole time he's chasing the man in black, and initially it seems like it's probably because of revenge or to stop him because he's bad. But at a certain point, Roland has this vision quest and is like, you need to reach the man in black because he will lead you to the Dark Tower. And I'm like, okay, why does he need to reach the Dark Tower? And when he gets to the Dark Tower, what's he gonna do? And I don't know.
It is the fact that when you're doing sort of a mystery box, I can not know what's going to happen, or I can be like, oh my god, you know, what did happen or where things are going. What I do want to know, though, is why I should care. That should never be the mystery box. Why should I give a shit and just open it up and like, now I know. That doesn't work, because then why would I the box?
I'm intrigued by the fact that the man in black serves any kind of power, and that's what's implied in this. Like, he says his boss, what's your boss called? And he says, Legion. But what he actually means by saying Legion of course being the only demon who's mentioned in the Bible, what he actually means by that is evil. Like, it's not literally a biblical monster. It's not Satan. He means, I serve a greater, potent, evil force. I'm really surprised that a man in black serves anything. I feel like that has to be a lie. Like, I would bet that a man in black probably is, like, an aspect of evil in of itself. But maybe that's just because I've read The Stand.
It certainly just makes me go, okay, so are you not the main villain? Like, who is evil? What are the stakes? When I read the next book, The Drawing of Three, where am I going? And why? It's too much to kind of lose connection. When he said Legion, by the way, have you ever seen the British sci-fi comedy Red Dwarf?
Yeah, I've seen some of it.
Right. There is an episode, season 6, I think it's episode 2 or 3, where they meet an alien called Legion. and it's literally a guy in a green morph suit, and that's all I could picture.
Legion is such an overdone character because he is so ubiquitous in the Bible, because he is like the only demon to actually like appear in the text of the Bible. I think others are like mentioned, like there are such a thing as demons. He's the only one who actually like shows up.
Well, I think I would have been a bit more excited if he'd just gone chaos or anarchy or just something like that. I'm just like, evil. I'm like, what's evil? Evil makes so little sense, obviously.
I mean,
to me.
Listen, when I say he serves evil, I mean that very broadly. Like, he, because actually, I will say that if I take the Man in Black, and to draw back the curtain a bit, I'm well aware that a Man in Black is the same character as Randall Flagg from The Stand, who is an amazing villain. And the thing about Randall Flagg is, the wonderful thing about him is that he is evil, but he's just this one potent force for evil that just likes mixing things up. And I would argue that he represents chaos a lot more than he does evil in and of itself. Because he arrives in the time of plague and he's empowered by the disaster and the suffering and the fear. Like, that's what makes him stronger. And most importantly, that's just humanity's fault. We engineered the virus. We created that fear to empower him. And he just loves it. So he can go around fucking people up and scaring people in their dreams and being an antichrist. But at the end of the day, he just relishes in the wickedness that we do. And he can inspire us to do. And that is so scary and interesting and threatening. And none of that's in this book. And The Stand came out before this one did.
Right. What was his name, sorry, by the way, in The Stand?
Randall Flagg.
Do you want to know who the villain is in For the Eyes of the Dragon?
Is it Randall Flagg?
It's Flagg the Hooded. He's the royal advisor to King Roland.
Oh, that's great. So we've both encountered him before.
Yeah. Oh my god, it's the same bloke.
That's actually great. We've run into him before. That's nice. Is he a good villain in that story?
Oh, he's amazing. Because what he is, he's like... I'm going to review Through the Eyes of the Dragon, because you know what? It's the best story in The Gunslinger. Eye of the Dragon's amazing, because what we have here is he's the royal advisor. He's the evil vizier. And obviously he's
perfect, and
brilliant in the role. But what's so good is that the story follows two sons of a king. And what we see is the slow manipulation of the second son to be evil and to be a bad king and to be the tyrant. But what it does is the fact that we follow the second son from a young age. And you see how like he starts out so innocent. And it's the slow manipulation throughout his entire childhood to be the person who betrays his brother, takes the throne, and becomes a tyrant. But it's so beautifully written, the way he's groomed, I guess is the right term for it, to be worth, to like build upon his, you know, his innocent childhood, but still his worst tendencies. And how even at the end, you're like, oh my god, this guy, he's not innocent, but in a way he still is. Like, it's not his fault, but it is his fault. It's a beautifully done story. And yeah, he is a master manipulator. And at the end of the story, I always confused because I was like, where's the sequel? Can the sequel flag, like, doesn't get caught and he disappears off? And it leads on this note of, you know, he will go off and cause havoc for years to come. It's made me want to read more of The Dark Tower now.
Genuinely, that is just a good idea. Like, Randall Flagg as a court vizier and like scheming behind the king's back, that's the perfect role for him. You can be reading there and you can go, sire, he means you ill, do not trust him.
It is a fantastic fantasy story. So I'm just going to drop this in now, because I was just reading up some trivia about the Eye of the Dragon. And did you know that the Eye of the Dragon was not only one of his earliest appearances with the use of the character of Randall Flagg, but also, it was apparently the reason why Stephen King wrote Misery.
Please go on, because I know why I think Stephen King wrote Misery, but go ahead.
Well, apparently, and this is coming from Wikipedia, Misery was written off the back of the reaction to Eyes of the Dragon, where King felt like he was trapped in a set genre and not allowed to change. And it's based off that fan reaction that he thought Misery was a good metaphor for how he was feeling.
Now, that is one explanation, and I'm not sure what source Wikipedia is using there. I'm going to tell you what I've heard Stephen King say his inspiration for Misery was. Now, a lot of people have said that, what's her name? Annie Wilkes, I think is the character's name in Misery, represents like an Uber fan who forces you to, you know, write what she wants you to write. What I've heard King say, and perhaps his story has changed, is that Annie represents cocaine.
Okay. Well, that is very different.
He's hooked to her, like he's tied up and hobbled by her. She's his biggest fan because she makes him think that he's the world's greatest writer, and she forces him to write. And Stephen King was very well known to write inspired by the influence of cocaine.
You made that sound like he read an article about him when I am inspired. Or he just has a picture of it on the wall. And goes,
hang on
yes.
In there, says a cat with ginormous eyeballs.
No, now imagine it. He's like just got a little picture on his desk, like where you have a family member and it's just a little pile. A little white pile on a table in the photo frame. Fair enough. My references are questionable at best. So, two very valid interpretations. If he ever talked to Stephen King, I'll ask him which one's true.
Very good.
So, back to the Gunslinger then. Geordie, I think we've made ourselves very clear on this. Do we recommend the Gunslinger?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't think it's a good book. I like it a lot. Talking to you about it, to be honest, I'm remembering a lot more of stuff I liked, like the background stuff about Roland and his past, and the way in which information like that is slowly squeaked out. But we barely talked about the final book because there's nothing to say about it. It's just long and dull and unsatisfying. But I really think we gotta keep reading these books.
What I think I would have to put down, I feel like you're not wrong, and I do want to see, because this is, by the way, it's the shortest book in the Dark Tower series by like half. All the other books, this book is like 250 odd. All the other books are like 480 plus. I would have to say, do I recommend The Gunslinger? I don't think The Gunslinger is a good book. I could only recommend it if I think the rest of the series is worth it. And there must be plenty of fans out there that do definitely think that. I think the main key thing is, if you're completely new to Stephen King, don't start here.
God, no.
In fact, you're probably best off if you're not going to read some of his most iconic horror fiction, like The Misery or The Shining or Carrie. Maybe you want to read either the other appearance of one of his, the character of Randall Flagg, the Man in Black, in The Eye of the Dragon. Or maybe you want to go and read The Stand if you need something massively chonky.
I can't really recommend The Stand for someone who isn't a Stephen King fan. It is a great book. I loved it. I want to reread it again in the future. But it's like 1,000 pages long.
Okay, that's it. I recommend The Eye of the Dragon. It's a great book. I loved it as a kid. There we go.
I guess it's time to move on to recommendations then. Or not recommendations. It's time to move on to picking the next book. Actually, as a little call to action, there are fans of the Dark Tower series out there. I would really like to hear from people on this. Should we keep going? Like, is the next book? How long do I have to wait for it to get good? Like, I cannot go through 2 books to wait for something to get good. It has to be at least the second book that it gets good. You know? That's how I do things.
I quite agree. To be honest, Jordy, one of the main things I always say is that, really, you shouldn't have to wait at all. Like, that's not on you.
You shouldn't, but sometimes you do.
That is true. And also,
I see this as a Trekkie.
Oh, mate, just skip to Season 5 Next Gen. It's where it's at. Right.
Season 5? Okay.
But also, what about, it might be the other way, Geordie. Can you imagine if people come back and go, what are you on about? The Gunslinger is the best one. And we'll just go, okay, not touching the rest. Hands are off.
Yeah, that would be galling if you're like, it's the best one. It's the best one, especially the Way Station. The Slow Mutants are like the scariest Stephen King's monster ever. I don't know what you're talking about, Geordie.
And if you hold those opinions...
Really what I want to see is Roland shoot Pennywise in the head. That's what I want.
And maybe that happens.
Reach out to us on our Instagram, Is This Just Fantasy Podcast, or... Is that what it's called?
Yep, that's our Instagram. Or you can...
Or on our email, isthisjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com. If you've read any of the other Dark Tower books, if you read any other Stephen King books, please let us know, because I really want to know, is it worth pressing on? But because we're not going to get an answer to that straight away, it's time for me, Geordie Bailey, to pick the next book. And I said, Duncan, right before we started rolling, that I want to mention two things. I want to flag something, a book which I am interested in reading, but I'm not ready to delve into yet.
Okay, what?
I've just had a weird hankering I've never had before, and I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to read The Wheel of Time.
You say what?
Yeah. I know I've used it as like a joke that it's something you're going to make me do, but I'm genuinely getting kind of intrigued by it.
You want to read The Eye of the World?
I think I might want to read
800 pages of the first half of The Fellowship.
Yes. Listen, now you're making me start to doubt myself.
You want to start a series that when I read the fifth book and went online and people said, that's one of the best ones, I stopped. Because if that was as good as it got, oh dear God.
I want to see, I do. Well, I want to see what the hell is going on over there.
I fully respect your decision. And it is in your power to make that call. But unfortunately, I have too many Destiny tokens. So you're not. Everyone, I get Destiny tokens, which is basically a way of forcing Geordie's hand. And I get these whenever he's late, on an episode release, or whenever he doesn't finish a book. And I've got a back pocket of about four of them at this point.
I think it's five now, after the latest episode. I have two, I think. Maybe one. I don't remember. We really should have written that down.
Don't you worry, Geordie. I keep track. Geordie, I did hear that impassionately, and I know you probably suspect us about to do this, and that's why you're teasing me. This is a tease on me, because I would like to read Eye of the World again. Because once you get a little bit deep into the series, it's one of those books I'm like, oh, if I revisited it, will I see it through different eyes? Will it be more? But damn it, Geordie knows that I want to read something different, and I'm going to make him. Because we're not long out of the month of May, and in May, I got a Star Wars kick. TV shows are coming out again. The Bad Batch ended. It was all great. And I really wanted to drag Geordie back in while the fires were hot. So, Geordie, keep the Eye of the World, put it back on the shelf, we will pick it up again. But I really want to read Heir of the Empire with you. Not Heir of the Empire, what am I on about? I'm blending titles here. Heir to the Empire with you. Star Wars, Heir to the Empire.
Right, yeah, of course, this being the first appearance of a character of Thrawn. This is a trilogy, right?
It is a trilogy, we're just going to read the first one. It is the first book...
Is it, like, complete if you don't finish the trilogy, or am I going to be on a cliffhanger and you're going to try and make me read the next one as well?
Definitely option B.
Gotcha. Great. Well, it better be pretty good. I read Star Wars Outbound Flight, that was it. And it was okay. I think Timothy Zahn really loves the character of Thrawn, so I'm intrigued to see his first entry and why he made such an impact on the Star Wars world that you cannot escape him despite the company literally changing hands and his entire story being deleted.
This is where it all comes back to. This was the real kickoff point for Star Wars Expanded Universe. I know, I feel like I've actually done dirty, like this massive tonal shift. I've gone, yeah, Stephen King, one of the greatest authors of all time. Here's multiverse. That's crap. Let's go and read some mass marketed corporate multiverse work. Not multiverse. Is it multiverse?
Duncan, you know this is going to come out in like June, right? It's not going to be May when this episode's released.
I know, but I need it now, Geordie. I'm excited for it. And I've already started reading
Okay. All right. Well, I'm pretty sure that they have copies of it at my Forbidden Planet, so I'll be heading on over there. Actually, I gotta say, speaking of Forbidden Planet, all right. I should have mentioned this in the what are we reading section, but I'll let you know now. So back years ago, when I was still living in Brighton with you, Duncan, Brighton being the city we both lived in, we didn't live together. I read a manga series I really like called How Do We Relationship, which is a great, very funny, but very sincere and serious story about a lesbian romance. And I have not been able to find any copies past issue 5 in about 4 years. And then I went up to Manchester to see some friends, and I find copies 6 through 10. All of the current releases. And I bought all of them in one go. And I've spent the last week reading this really amusing, really heartfelt and sincere and emotionally complicated romance story.
And you didn't think to mention this in its normal slot in the episode.
No, I forgot. I'm
well,
sorry.
Well, if you're listening to this and think Jordy should feel more shame, do reach out to us and tell us on our Instagram, This Is Fantasy Podcasts.
Star Wars it is. I've been your host, Jordy Bailey, dragged once again back to a galaxy far, far away.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nichol. Don't hate us for not liking Stephen King.
Bye-bye!